Okay, thanks, Diane. I appreciate you actually inviting me here. And I'm looking out in the audience, and about half the audience are my people. And this is not who I intended to speak to. I sat through about half the presentations this morning, and they were excellent presentations. But I think I was invited not just because of the fact that I focused on phosphorus and phosphorus management for a while, but because I've had a kind of a critical perspective through some experiences of soil health as it's gained as a movement. And so I felt as if maybe there was an attempt to co-opt me into the story. I must say that after this morning, the messages that I heard about soil health and its adaptation were spot on. And so what I want to do today is give kind of a basic presentation on phosphorus management with some reflections on soil health. And really where it's easily compatible with water quality and phosphorus management, and where there are potential conflicts or ones that I've even seen. I'm going to acknowledge Doug Smith, who's in the audience, and then Kevin King, who's busy doing field work out in the Lake Erie watershed. I'll begin with the easy message. And this is one that if you look at soil health, it clearly comes out of this long tradition of focusing on soils and building on soil conservation. In fact, I wanted to give a little bit of my own background just to say that I grapple with being a critic here, and that is I came out of a natural resource background. I was in natural resources at Cornell. You know, I've read Leopold. You know, I've read Emerson. That's what, you know, it brings me to this field, and that was the change I wanted to make in my life was on resource management. But I've now worked for about 25 years in the area of phosphorus. I started working in Indonesia in the rainforest there on slash and burn agriculture, and I witnessed firsthand the inefficiencies associated with natural nutrient cycling. It's not optimized, and I guess that's something that I wanted to kind of drill home right now. And then move back, and I've spent more or less the last 18 years working on first world issues of nutrient runoff and phosphorus loss. And we've gone through a tremendous period of growth in terms of our knowledge as to why phosphorus moves and how it moves. There's still more to learn. But the old message was basically the one that you see here, and it justifies essentially a soil conservation-based approach to phosphorus management. These are some data from Andrew Sharpley with some unit source watersheds that were located in Oklahoma, and which they had two paired watersheds that were managed identically for a while. They imposed no-till on one after a period of time, and you see a tremendous reduction in erosion and the amount of phosphorus that's lost, the concentrations here, but also the volumes that were lost, the mass that were lost, declined in association with soil conservation. This is a message that soil health easily caters to, one in which soil conservation equals phosphorus conservation or phosphorus mitigation from a water quality standpoint. But I'm not interested in focusing on that. They're real problems that go much beyond the soil conservation perspective that have to do with phosphorus, and they involve trade-offs. We heard about trade-offs this morning, and so there's a real need to move from sales to reality, from a sales pitch to one in which we're very real about what the trade-offs are, and we really avoid the sacred cows that we all have. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about water quality and soil health at the level of kind of a pedon or you know, soil point. And then we'll move up in scale, and we'll reflect a little bit on what approaches are needed for soil health to be relevant as we go up to a landscape scale and to a watershed scale. And I want to end with basically an open question about drainage. Okay, I'm going to start with my experience with soil health very early on. I was invited with a few others to advise on basically Lake Erie, which is one of the hotspot areas for our research right near. It's associated, you have toxic algal blooms associated with dissolved phosphorus loadings to the lake. Politically, it's a very politically charged environment, and it's one in which you kind of bring out the best and worst, I think, of messages. And so it was quite, I anticipated with a lot of enthusiasm some of the first reports that come out. There was a report that came out that basically was focused on the state of the science of phosphorus, what was known for Lake Erie. This came out of Ohio. And the first section that was inserted here, and this is really an insinuation of a movement, was on soil health. starting with some very logical, broad statements, but ending in some things that weren't helpful. And what you see is an equation of soil health with practices. And so the practices that we see over and over again associated with healthy soils are cover crops and no-till. These are very, very important from a soil conservation perspective, but they're also practices that are not perfectly optimized. And here's the kind of statement that we see. This is the kind of thing that can really jazz somebody, that can really inspire somebody. There's a lot in there, but it says, basically, if you have a healthy soil, there'll be little to no water runoff, and the nutrients will infiltrate and percolate through the soil via matrix flow. That is, they won't bypass. There'll be just a perfectly closed system right there. And this is wishful thinking. This is not the way that you take a serious movement and you move it forward to folks. So let's just go a little bit into this. So the first you have this kind of overstatement of the optimized system. And we have to recognize that our production systems are incredibly inefficient. They're inefficient from the standpoint of all types of resources that we use, including phosphorus. So phosphorus is an incredibly sticky element. We basically fertilize the soil in order to fertilize our crops. So we're already working through a medium rather than going directly to where we want to grow things. And because it's so sticky, there's very little diffusion that occurs. You really have to get the phosphorus in the area of the plant roots, which grow down. And so we do a lot of things to basically take natural buffers out of our soils so that we can make more phosphorus stay in the soil solution and less of it stick to the soil itself and remain in particle-bound form. And that's the basis of our nutrient management. We're feeding the soil solution. We're trying to move from soils to have a high buffer capacity and relatively low concentrations of phosphorus in the soil solution to ones in which we can sustain higher concentrations in the soil solution. So that works very, very well from a production standpoint. In fact, is the basis of the Green Revolution and the incredible yields that we now see today. But there's a consequence, particularly when you build up well beyond what the crop requires. And so here's a basic relationship you see for dissolved phosphorus loss in overland flow. It's a literature review that Pete Vadas did while he was in our lab about a decade ago. Basically looked across a number of runoff studies, plotted them all there, and if you squint your eyes, you basically see more phosphorus in the soil using a readily available soil test, more dissolved phosphorus concentration in runoff. And then that band on your left right there is the band of the agronomic optimum. So clearly he had studies that went much beyond the agronomic optimum. And you see that how high the concentrations can go. But even in that range, we still have some increase associated with increased malic-3 phosphorus. Here data from Kevin King, who's been out monitoring tile drains in the Lake Erie Basin, and what he did basically was just for a number of the fields that he was monitoring, he threw his data together, looked at the medians, and related them to the surface soil P concentrations, the malic-3 phosphorus concentration, the upper 5 centimeters or 2 inches, and you see a similar relationship. You know, there are unequal variances and all that, but basically as you climb up in terms of the concentration of phosphorus in the surface soil, you also get increases of concentration in tile drain effluent. Okay, so what do we know then? Kind of, generally speaking, the more phosphorus in soil, the greater the concentrations in runoff. And what I've showed you so far is that agronomic measures seem to kind of work well enough. Okay, so if you're looking for making inferences from tools that we already have out there, you can use agronomic tests. There's some others that people are interested in, and they can help to improve insight in particular conditions. But from a soil health standpoint and going out and testing soils, you know, using readily available agronomic information gives you really some pretty good insight in the potential for P release from soils. Now, part of the question is where do we look? Is soil just a homogeneous, you know, type of thing out there? Does it just occur in one dimension, two dimensions, three dimensions? We'll get into a little bit of that. That was basically to go after the optimized system, and that is, I showed you the dissolved phosphorus loss occurs as we increase phosphorus in the soils. The next thing has to do with a statement that I showed you about optimizing basically water cycling in soils as a function of our soil management. And so this comes from a well-established history of looking at what we call infiltration excess runoff. So infiltration excess runoff follows basically the thought process that soils have a finite capacity to to allow water to percolate through them, and that if a rainstorm comes on board and dumps rain on top of it, the infiltration capacity of the soil controls the rate of runoff, how much water can go in versus going to go off. That's something that, yes, to a point we can manage, and that's where things like residue structure, building soil structure, more organic matter, improving storage, improving infiltration capacity. That's something that we can manage. But then there are forms of runoff that occur out in our landscapes, including in our natural forested landscapes that do have, you know, surface runoff, that are much, much more difficult to manage from a point scale, from a head-on scale. And these are ones that involve landscape processes. And so this is the well-established concept of Dunn of saturation excess runoff, in which we have rainwater that's accumulated in our soils, either as a result of antecedent conditions or as a result of shallow lateral flows from upslope to downslope. This is oftentimes perched runoff water that then saturates the soil. You can basically spit on that soil and it's going to run off because it's waterlogged. Okay, so that's much more. So what do we do to manage those? Well, basically our main tool there is drainage. We can drain the water away, but we're not going to be able to change those surface soil conditions and affect runoff here. Here's some data that come from Tony Buda in which we looked at saturation conditions in one of the watersheds that we monitor in central Pennsylvania. You've got some conditions there. You have one soil with a frangipan that occurs down about 2 feet. Frangipan is just a hard pan that's relatively impermeable. And then another soil that's upslope that has no frangipan on top of it. The upslope one is well drained, the downslope one is poorly drained, and when we send technicians out there to basically do the squishy boot analysis and map out where the saturated areas are, you see at certain times of the year, here's August, we'll get saturated areas, they're down in the frangipan, and then later in the year when the conditions are a little wetter, we don't have as much ET, they expand, but they're pretty much associated with these lower landscape positions. Those areas tend to be hydrologically connected. This will be one point that I make in a few slides. They tend to connect to the stream channel, and they're also areas that are very, very hard to manage from just a soil perspective, trying to change that infiltration rate. So when we look at the runoff that occurs from them, upslope in the well-drained areas, we get infiltration excess type runoff. Downslope, we get saturation excess type of runoff. Okay, so let's talk about what we know about managing runoff. Okay, so I'll start first with the erosion, and I said, so we can manage erosion. Soil conservation is something that we have a tremendous history that we build on, and that has to do with principles of putting and maintaining cover, protecting the soil surface, improving the structure of our soils, and really working on the types of practices that aren't going to affect infiltration in other ways. Same thing applies for infiltration excess runoff. So that's an easy translation when we're talking about surface runoff. With saturation excess runoff, you don't have those same options. And so this is well established. Okay, I heard some nice talks this morning that had to do with where do we sample in the soil. And the issue here is vertical stratification. And vertical stratification is something that can happen very, very quickly with regard to phosphorus in the soils. Here's a study that Andrew Sharpley did. It was over 10 years, but it basically illustrates the point, where he amended soils with various rates of poultry litter. And what you see are basically an increase in the phosphorus content of the soil at the surface over that period of time in association with the rate of application. That surface, really why I want to put this slide in here, that's the effective depth of interaction. So we've got a lot of research that looks at, for surface runoff, what is the source of soil phosphorus to that surface runoff? And it's really that veneer of soil that sits right on the surface, the upper couple of centimeters of soil. So that's an incredibly important area to be looking at from a phosphorus management standpoint. Same thing applies actually to tile drainage. I was talking about overland flow with regard to that, but here's that slide again that we saw of Kevin King's, in which he's able to explain a good amount of the variability in the concentration of phosphorus that he sees, dissolved phosphorus coming out of his tile lines, in association with just measuring the phosphorus in the upper 2 inches of the soils of the fields that they're draining. And so you have this basically accumulation of phosphorus in certain areas that then controls its loss from the field. So this can be problematic in that, basically one measure of soil phosphorus may not relate to another need. And so Doug Smith had done some work basically looking at agronomic response. We tend to sample deeper for basically agronomic inferences, and that's because roots grow down again. And so he sampled the upper 2 inches right there. You see no relationship with corn yield. But then when he sampled just below those in these soils, he got a nice relationship. And so what we look at from an environmental standpoint and what we measure from an agronomic standpoint do not necessarily gather together. They don't necessarily overlap in a perfect way. We'd like that to happen, but they don't necessarily, that doesn't necessarily happen. So vertical stratification is something that in our healthy systems happened. I mentioned that I spent about a year, year and a half in Indonesia, and I saw severe vertical stratification in the forests of Borneo there. And so that has to do with basically the accumulation of litter. We fertilize the surface. The same thing happens in watersheds where dissolved phosphorus losses are a concern, where you don't have continuous no-till, but you do have rotational no-till. So no-till's happening as part of the rotation, but then you also have some cultivation that's happening. These are from some of the Western Lake Erie watersheds. This is work out of Heidelberg University, in which they basically did soil sampling to various depths, up to 20 centimeters there, and you see that the mean for a 20 centimeter sample is 36, which is in it's the low end of the agronomic optimum. But then when you break those samples up into their vertical distribution, you can see how high the concentrations can get at the surface. Again, those surface samples are the ones that correlate very well then to the tile drainage that Kevin King was monitoring. So if you build up the phosphorus in the soils by repeated applications over time, it can be extremely difficult to draw it down just by the process of what we call phytoremediation. That is using the plant to harvest the nutrient from the soil. Even if back of the envelope calculations, mass balances tell you that, yes, okay, we're going to take 30 to 50 pounds an acre out, we should see this. If your soils are very high, and here I've got some soils from the eastern shore of Maryland, that are up at 400. They're almost an order of magnitude more than what we need to grow a crop. It can take a tremendously long time to draw those down. So we basically looked at trying to do phytoremediation here, and over a decade, we got nowhere in terms of our soil test phosphorus. And the concentrations of phosphorus that we observed in dish flow right there were no. It takes a long time if you allow that phosphorus to build up and to remain at high levels in a soil. So one option is tillage. And to me, this seems like a logical consideration. Not an endpoint, but it's something that in certain situations should be considered. But for those who've spent a career in soil conservation and who are looking at other factors, this is apocryphal. This is maybe the worst thing that you can be recommending out there. And that has to do with the fact they're looking at other objectives. Their objectives are not necessarily the control of dissolved phosphorus. So I want to show you a really elegant study that Andrew Sharpley did while he was at our lab back in the early 2000s. He was my mentor, so I refer to him a lot. And so he did a study where he had a couple of soils. This is in the field, actually. And they basically were nearby each other. They had a relatively high phosphorus content, so almost 500 right there. Their phosphorus sorption saturation, that is the amount of phosphorus in the surface soil relative to the ability to bind it, we look at that by iron aluminum, was also fairly high. And he did a series of rainfall simulations, and what you see with that blue line is basically the concentrations of phosphorus that we got in runoff. He then imposed tillage on the partner soil. And what you saw in the short term was certainly, you could call it catastrophic. It was bad. You saw an increase in the concentrations of total phosphorus in runoff that had a large part to do with the amount of erosion that happened. But over time, the soils were stabilized with a perennial forage. You actually saw a reduction in the concentrations of phosphorus that were lost from there. And that had in large part to do with the fact that you're bringing sorption capacity up from down below. You're mixing that phosphorus that's at the surface with basically particles that have an ability to remove it from the soil solution. So his soil test, his agronomic soil test, dropped down from 495 to 136, and the sorption saturation went from 65% to 7%. And so this needs to be considered in the toolbox of mitigation options. And yet, when we go down certain routes, we end up ruling it out. And we cannot be serious about watershed management and rule out our options. Okay, so I want to have some take. Wayne Honeycutt asked me to be productive and constructive and not just to tear down things, so that's it. So what do? We avoid vertical stratification of soils in order to promote both soil health and water quality. We need regular soil sampling of the surface so that we can see rates of accumulation, and we should be looking at the surface saturation. I didn't go far into that, but we really want to be considering our ability to bind the additions that we get there. And then we need to be looking across the range of options for putting phosphorus to where the roots grow so that it's not just sitting up there on the surface. And that sometimes may involve tillage in order to move it down in soils in which it's accumulated, but also on the 4R sustainability or nutrient stewardship approach, you want to look at placement and rates of application and be very precise about that. Okay, I'm going to go now to kind of wrap up here and wax a little bit philosophic here because I wanted to follow up on this morning's presentations. Our basic approach, and it's adopted not just in the U.S., but really around the world, for trying to mitigate phosphorus loss at a watershed level, is to go after what we call critical source areas. These are areas that are hydrologically active, and they also have a good amount of phosphorus in them. So we try to disconnect the sources from the transport. So here's that watershed we showed before with saturated area. If you looked at the type of runoff that comes from the fields there, upslope, you had mostly infiltration excess. That's what you can manage through a good emphasis on building soil structure and keeping cover. Downslope, we had primarily saturation excess runoff that was occurring. That was runoff that was occurring as a result of perch water tables. When you looked at where the phosphorus sat in the soils, most of it sat upslope. And so 177, 144, much more than what you need to grow a crop. The sorption saturation of the soils was, not too high, but it was higher than what we had downslope, which had the lowest concentrations of phosphorus in there. And so we could relate very well. Tony Buddha looked at the amount of phosphorus in the soil, related very well to the concentration, that is the mass per unit volume of phosphorus in runoff. But then when we looked at the load, what are we delivering actually to the stream, we saw that the largest loads were coming out of the lower area, which was not receiving any additional inputs of phosphorus. And this was entirely due to a couple of things. First of all, the amount of runoff that was happening there, but also because of its connectivity. This is a very connected site. It runs straight to the watershed outlet. And so from this standpoint, we need to be looking at soil health across the landscape and differentiating between soils that are hydrologically active and those that are less hydrologically active. There's certainly some excellent techniques out there for improving our mapping. Right now, we have a fairly coarse approach to mapping our soils, and there's a lot of work in podology looking at trying to improve our ability to identify where these saturated areas occur. So that's hopeful. That needs to be part of the soil health assessment, and that is we need to consider connectivity and hydrologic activity. But we also need to consider in these hydrologically active areas, do we need to be managing them with our general agronomic guidelines, or do we need to look elsewhere? Do we need to have a different type of an approach? We have an incredibly opaque soil fertility recommendation system right now. And this is, Doug Smith is talking on this at the conference. A lot of folks recognize this. You can go from state to state, even within state, and find different soil testing protocols that are used. Everybody has their own technique. Historically, there's been a very, very little emphasis on trying to promote uniformity. We need to look across, not just correlations across state boundaries, but look openly at the basis of our decisions. There are a lot of assumptions that go into the recommendations that we make. The fertilizer response curves that we have oftentimes are nebulous clouds in which judgment calls were made as to where thresholds existed. This has to become very, very transparent. This is something the Australians have done to some effect with their better fertilizer decision program. And so I just have an example right here of kind of whether when you base your crop recommendations on deficiency correction or maintenance. This is resulting in some across the state, I won't mention the states right now, but right now there's some real concerns in some of our U.S. states with regard to the fertilizer recommendation rates that are happening in the state boundary, and they have to do with whether or not one scientist really decided to go with the deficiency correction or the maintenance. In these hydrologically active areas, I hope I showed you that even just a little bit of phosphorus can result in a large delivery of phosphorus to the stream. I want to finish with drainage, and this is just an open question to everyone, and it comes from my brief experience in Lake Erie, and that was, I was quickly attacked for recommending tillage as a means of mitigating hyperstratification of phosphorus in soils, but there seemed to be very, very little appetite for approaching the question is, are healthy soils automatically well-drained soils? What about drainage? What does drainage do to soil health if you're in naturally wet landscapes here? So when we drain our landscapes, we basically expand our critical source areas. We're increasing connectivity. This is a basic drainage slide that basically shows that, we lower water tables, the travel times increase, we increase the connectivity. Yeah, I'm just about done. And Tony Buda has this just to illustrate on a high P soil that if you were to intensify your drainage, you're also activating different areas that previously were inactive. This is a flat landscape on the eastern shore of Maryland. Work out of the Midwest shows that basically as you increase your drainage density, you reduce the travel time exponentially, and so basically you're taking natural buffers, things that would remove phosphorus, out of the equation. When we look at tile drainage, these are some data from Kevin King, we see that the phosphorus in that tile drainage basically moves in a punctuated fashion. It moves with events, and oftentimes those concentrations are tied to the flow as we activate sources at the soil surface. We really need to see tile drainage as surface runoff through pipes. So here's some well-used photos that come from Marty Chapatel and Frank Gibbs, in which they forced smoke up through tile drains, and in order to identify connections between the tile drains and the soil surface. You can see that in the lower left. And in the center, it may be hard to see, that's a casting of an earthworm burrow, the kind of thing that you would want to see in a healthy soil. But in this case, think of it as a pipe delivering a nutrient, which is a resource at the surface, and making it into a pollutant when it's down below. Okay, so what can we do? We can disconnect sources, and I think this is kind of pie in the sky right now. So we can go ahead and map out our tile drains, and we can really focus on variable rate applications and not applying over those drains, because most of that connectivity occurs in a very short distance from the drain itself. This is a tall order, but it's certainly something that we hope to move through. The other thing is that we can also consider other ways of disconnecting. And so here's a study that we did in which we looked at phosphorus leaching in some Pennsylvania soils in which phosphorus was showing up in basically groundwater at a house that had been using that as their source of drinking water. Before we applied manure, you can see the concentrations on the left. Afterward, we either broadcast or we tilled in the manure. So what we were doing there was we're incorporating that manure, breaking up the manure, putting it in contact with the soil where it could be bound, and we're also diluting the concentrations of phosphorus at any particular point. And you see the reduction that comes with that type of activity. This isn't the only approach, tillage, to it, but it is following a basic principle of putting that new phosphorus in contact with the existing sorption capacity of the soil. So this is my last slide, and this is, again, I have no great answer for this. It's just something that I think has to be part of the open conversation that I understand is being fostered right now through the serious efforts to bring soil health to the fore. And what does artificial drainage do to soil health? So what happens when we change drainage status? I think that's, a profound question that needs to be grappled with as we move beyond the rhetoric of promoting certain properties. And then the next thing is, what do we do to slow down and avoid bypass flows? We have tools that are out there. We'll probably hear about some of them in upcoming talks. Those have to be contrasted with, intensification of drainage. This isn't just about slapping a new Band-Aid on a wound. This is also about what kind of strategies do we have from the standpoint of our soil management in which we're looking down the road at the potential to make things worse through our current actions. So that's basically it. I want to end with a very relevant paper from Robert Merton's published. He was a Harvard professor who worked in the 30s on looking at the trade-offs associated with social action, and that's essentially what all of us who are in management are engaged in. You know, we're pushing programs. We've got to be careful about overselling them and being aware of what the implications are in areas that we had not considered initially. So that's my talk on phosphorus. Thank you.